Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The census only happens once every 10 years, and experts will tell you it's mostly a political tool. But the national headcount might actually be the ultimate economic indicator. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt. It's more car than electric. And by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at NovoNordisk-US.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 21st of December 2010. Good to have you with us. 308,754,538. That's how many Americans there are. I suppose technically you could call it a lagging indicator since the official date for the census was this past April the 1st. But, you know, it takes a while to sort through the data. And that's what people have been doing all day, mostly to talk about the politics of it, which states gained population and so will get more representation in the House and which states will lose. But the data at the core is really people, workers and consumers, potential homeowners and future retirees. So we asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman what the numbers say about them and the economy they live in.
The U.S. population rose by nearly 10% in the last decade, but that was actually the slowest growth since the Great Depression. And for that, you can thank the Great Recession. A bad economy has kept the birth rate and immigration down. Early in the decade, population was also shifting a lot, with millions of people moving from the Rust Belt to the Sun Belt in search of jobs or a cozy retirement.
These trends might have been more pronounced had it not been for the recession.
Kenneth Johnson is a demographer at the University of New Hampshire.
Domestic migration, people moving from one place in the United States to another, really slowed down considerably in the last couple of years.
So although Sunbelt states gained population, they probably would have gained even more if their housing and job markets hadn't crashed so hard.
Economies in Arizona, Nevada, or Florida are very dependent on growth itself.
Texas bucked the trend, though. Economist Ray Perryman leads a forecasting firm in Waco.
Texas did better than most states during the recession, and we did continue to receive some in-migration during the recession. It slowed down some, but continued at a pretty good pace, which is about 1,100 people a day. So it's a remarkable amount of economic growth.
Across the South, a big chunk of the increased population is Hispanic, both immigrants and their U.S.-born children.
Which, again, brings infrastructure challenges, education challenges, and other things, but also gives us a young workforce, in some cases a very well-talented and trained workforce, and that's been something that's given us a competitive edge.
Because the Hispanic population is young, it's poised to spend heavily in coming years on higher education, first homes, and all the consumer goods needed to fill them. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
As expected, the Federal Communications Commission voted on new rules for the Internet today. Net neutrality is the buzzword you may have heard. The new rules mean some companies that provide online content, Netflix, for instance, could wind up paying more because downloaded movies, just as an example, take up a whole lot more bandwidth than other content does. Also, the rules make a distinction between good old-fashioned Internet connections, the ones where a wire plugs into the back of your computer, and the web that you can get wirelessly, say, on your mobile phone. From New York, Marketplace's Janet Babin has that story.
Here's what FCC Commissioner Michael Kopp said about the year-long agency effort.
The Internet was born on openness. It thrived on openness. And it will achieve its full potential only through continued openness.
But openness is in the eye of the beholder. The rules do prohibit unreasonable discrimination on the Internet, so big cable and telephone companies that provide Internet service can't favor their own websites over others. And the rules protect us Internet subscribers. We get to access all the legal Internet content that's out there, not just what our service provider wants us to see. But the FCC rules say broadband companies are allowed to manage data on their systems. Sasha Meinrath at the New America Foundation calls that language a loophole. He fears it means the price of Internet access for some companies and for us could rise, and that could shape what websites become our favorites.
Downloading a video or watching any content or even visiting a website may go faster or slower depending on whether the host of that website or that content pays an extra little bit to the network operators.
But many of us access the internet through wireless devices or wireless connections these days, and these FCC rules give wireless companies even more leeway to manage their data traffic. Columbia Law Professor Tim Wu says that could also lead to discrimination.
Let's say you buy a phone from Verizon, and all the Google stuff works really great, but Microsoft stuff and doesn't really work well at all.
The final rules aren't officially out yet, but already some consumer groups and others are considering legal challenges. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
A note now about our story on net neutrality from yesterday's broadcast. Before we go on, contrary to what we said, both sides of the internet connection do wind up paying, customers at home and content providers. Netflix or anybody else running a website needs a connection to reach you as much as you need one to reach them. Speaking of paying, today the Senate passed a bill to pay the government's bills through early March. It's called a continuing resolution, which is a pretty good description of what it does. It continues federal agencies and their funding levels at the dollar amounts they had in 2010. And that's a little tricky because when that funding level was set, there was no Health Care Act or financial reform law on the books. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports now from Washington.
Congress passes laws, but federal agencies have to implement them. For sweeping overhauls, that takes serious cash. Teddy Downey is a policy analyst at MF Global. He says agencies writing rules for financial reform won't have the money to hire more enforcement staff.
There will be certainly more room to get around the new rules because of the lack of funding, lack of oversight.
There also won't be any funding for an exchange the law requires for trading derivatives. Height Analytics policy analyst Patrick Hughes says Wall Street will have plenty to say on the new rules, but the Commodity Futures Trading Commission doesn't have enough people right now to sift through all the comments.
The question is whether the CFTC, without sufficient funding, will have the bandwidth to review those comments and incorporate worthwhile suggestions from industry.
Much of the healthcare overhaul doesn't take effect until 2014, so it doesn't need as much upfront money. But the Department of Health and Human Services still has to write rules. It's also short-staffed and will have a hard time taking in comments. That will lead to frustration, according to Deborah Cholet, a health policy analyst at Mathematica Policy Research.
At the end of the day, the insurance companies, the doctors, the hospitals, the patients, everyone would prefer a more orderly process.
Congress will take up the budget again next year. Republicans will be in charge of the House, so we'll have a lot more say in the process. And some want to cut long-term funding for the health care law. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Things were moderately positive on Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. There are three full days and a scant few shopping hours left until Christmas. The good retail news is that early reports show Americans are buying more this holiday season. That'll be a nice boost when the final numbers come out after the holidays. The bad news, though, is that if you've waited until the last minute, yeah, you might be out of luck. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
Retail analyst Jennifer Black says Old Navy had quite the pajama sale last weekend. Maybe you could call it more of a pajama rush.
The next day, there were no pajamas in the entire chain.
Okay, almost.
There were a few left online in large sizes that were weird prints.
Black says the recession made retailers cautious.
Because they were terrified and consumers weren't buying anything. So how did they order for the next year? Well, they didn't order very much.
And that, she says, is why Coach, for instance, sold out of in-demand bags. Amazon's been having trouble keeping the Kindle in stock. And when it comes to toys like dance star Mickey, yeah, there are reports Mickey hasn't exactly been in the house everywhere. Scott Krugman of the National Retail Federation says the shelves aren't totally bare. Stores are just playing it safe.
Because of that, we're not seeing unplanned markdowns. And I think that means the industry got it right.
Mike Walden, a consumer economist at North Carolina State University, says merchants could see this holiday season as a green light to stock more next year.
that, however, could set them up for somewhat of a disaster if we don't see the economy perhaps maintain this nice rebound.
Or, say others, maybe Santa will just leave a lot more rain checks in stockings for years to come. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Christmas and the holidays are, if nothing else, a chance for kids to dream big, to ask Santa for that pony or for the hottest gadget that they can think of. That's how it is that my six-year-old somehow believes there's going to be an iPad waiting for him under the tree Saturday morning. But more kids are using smartphones and tablet computers, their parents or their own, thanks to all the educational and gaming apps that are out there. And Marketplace's Megan Larson reports the rest of the kids' toy market is watching all this very carefully.
Here's how it all began. My family was driving to Santa Barbara, up the coast from Los Angeles. What should have taken an hour and a half turned into 3 hours on the road in stop-and-go traffic. My two-year-old was getting itchy, so I was getting itchy. We sang songs, played I Spy, ate snacks, and read books. I was running out of ideas, and the itchiness turned to tears. I myself wanted to cry, so I forked over my iPhone, and it worked brilliantly.
That's exactly how we got started. When I first got my iPhone, I saw how my then two-year-old just, you know, quickly picked up my phone and started to use it.
Caroline Hugh Flexer is the co-founder of DuckDuckMoose, an independent developer of iPhone and iPad apps. 2 years ago, she says there weren't many applications she could feel good about letting her toddler use. So she and her partners came up with some.
The wheels on the bus go round and round, round and round, round and round. The wheels.
It's very close to manipulations in the real world. So if you want to move something across the screen, you move it kind of in the direction that you want it to go, sort of like moving a toy across a table.
The touchscreen is really easy for little fingers to use, and there are now so many app options from Starfall ABCs to Cookie Doodle to Dora's Big Birthday Adventure. It's no wonder that at the end of the day, my son would rather see my phone than me. Imagine if I had an iPad. Sean McGowan is a toy industry analyst at Needham & Company.
It's not surprising that somebody would look at the iPad and all its features and say, wow, this would be a really cool toy. I won't say that it would be the number one toy. It is still rather expensive, and it is still made of glass. But I think it is a great potential toy for kids, especially with all the applications that anybody would say would be great things for kids to have.
There are more than 300,000 apps for the iPhone and iPad, another 100,000 available for Google's Android phone. The education portion is still pretty slim, maybe 5%, but it is expected to grow with the rest of the app market. Exact figures are hard to come by, but market research firm IDC projects that the total app market will rake in about $35 billion by 2014. Now, if you're feeling a little guilty about handing over your not-so-cheap phone or tablet computer to your kid for screen time, there is evidence that kids can learn from some of these apps. And this has caught the attention of the kids' toy market, especially companies like Leapfrog and VTech that specialize in electronic educational toys. Analyst McGowan covers Leapfrog.
It certainly is front and center on the minds of the companies that are putting these products out, and the executives probably go to bed every night wondering, how am I going to turn this potential threat into an opportunity?
And there is opportunity. McGowan says the best part of Leapfrog's products, for example, is the content, not the plastic casings they come in. So when the day comes that you can buy a quality $99 tablet computer, and he says that day is coming soon, McGowan figures that parents just might opt for the glass product over the plastic one.
I see this as eventually becoming the preferred delivery method for educational software that today is being delivered through kind of bulky plastic and chip formats.
I'll be waiting for that. In the meantime, I just wish someone would create an app that would make my kid give me my phone back. I'm Megan Larson for Marketplace.
Coming up, poverty's there even when you can't see it.
Rowntree was wanting to show that these conditions existed everywhere. They existed in pretty little cities like York, and something ought to be done about them.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials picked up 55 points today, about a half percent, closed at 11,533. The NASDAQ added 18 points, about two-thirds percent, to end things at 2667. The S&P 500 tacked on 7 points, six-tenths percent, finished at 1254. Financials led the charge. Bank of America pocketed gains of nearly 3% today. J.P. Morgan Chase deposited 2 2/3%. Shares of the insurance giant AIG puffed up nearly 3 1/3% today. That after reports Uncle Sam plans to sell a big piece of its stake in the company. In technology, Adobe Systems jumped 6% on upbeat earnings forecasts. Elsewhere, the maker of baby food ingredients, Martek Biosciences Corporation, rocketed more than 35% higher after the Dutch company DSM announced plans to buy it. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.3%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at vanguard.com/public radio. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
State Book, here's a look at events coming up tomorrow. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its final third quarter gross domestic product report. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for the month of November. And President Obama is scheduled to sign into law an act repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. So, you had enough of all those holiday shopping catalogs jamming your mailbox yet? You'd think that in this digital age we'd be done with them, and yet they keep on coming with their scarily perfect pictures of somebody's idea of interior decorating nirvana. Those pictures, though, and their perfectness, gave actor and comedian Molly Erdman an idea. It eventually became the website Catalog Living, about a fictional couple living in the world of furniture catalogs. Molly, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
You need to explain this one a little bit to the folks because it's a little odd. It's a website and a storyline, I guess you could say, based on shopping catalogs.
Well, I have this website and I started it based off of coming home late one night and looking at a West Elm catalog and thinking there were some pretty ridiculous scenarios being put out there. Specifically, an outdoor patio setting where there was a tray of figs under the table on the ground. And I think that was sort of my breaking point.
And
I just thought,
you snap.
Yeah, who lives like this?
Let's run people through sort of the experience of seeing the site. So you go to catalogliving.net, and it's a bunch of pictures taken from actual catalog.
That's right.
And
yeah.
You?
I do a new one every day and just create a, you know, one-sentence caption that is either said by or about Gary and or Elaine, this couple created for the website.
Yeah, tell us about Gary and Elaine. Who are they, these people you've created?
They're sort of this, you know, probably in their 40s couple, very wealthy because they have...
Because it's all really expensive.
An incredible amount of furniture and real estate. They have an unknown number of kids, but it's a large amount, varying in age from infants to teenagers. Gary's sort of the bumbling fool, and Elaine, you know, hands on her hips, always telling him what
homemaker.
To do. Right, exactly.
This idea of perfection, though. I mean, it's all so perfect in these catalogs, and yet, really, we can't ever get there.
No, I think that's sort of what has struck a nerve doing this website. It's because I, for years, you know, would get these Pottery Barn catalogs and things like that and look through them and think, oh, if only I had this bedside table. you know, things would fall into place and my life would be perfect. And so, you know, you try to live up to these standards that are in these catalogs. So taking them down a peg seems to please people.
You've brought some catalogs with you. I see a bunch of them there in front of you. There's Pottery Barn, right?
Pottery Barn, to me, is sort of, it says it all.
Right.
So this is their, a lot of holiday gift ideas. If you are concerned about the warmth of the tops of your bottles of wine, they have scarves and hats.
Oh, my God. Look at that. It's a little hat.
To put over your wine bottles.
All right. Wait. I have to look for the price tag here. Hold on.
Probably it's, more than any bottle of wine
toppers.
I would buy.
It's a Santa hat and scarf set. $8. Not bad. So I'll take
sure.
three of those.
Great.
Right? And then, you know, $25 out the window.
Right.
I sound so cheap here. That's... But anyway. These catalogs, you know, these pictures do kind of lend themselves to the bizarre. What are some of the wildest things you've seen?
There has been a strange trend in animals in rooms. The Pier 1 catalog, I think just before the holidays, people just kept sending it to me because there's a living room with a miniature unicorn in it. Just standing there?
I have one in mine. You don't have one in yours?
I'm getting a new one.
Yeah, you had to put the other one down.
Right, and, right.
Yeah. Is it a little bit of laughing so you don't cry?
Kind of.
Yeah.
I think so. And I think that's why people enjoy the site is
right.
instead of being like, oh, boo-hoo, I can't have these things, then it's like, oh, why would I want those anyway?
I don't want them anyway. Molly Erdman. The website is called catalogliving.net. We've got a slideshow of some of those pictures Molly was talking about and also a link to her blog. It's at our website, marketplace.org. Molly, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Over in the UK, the Brits are having their first Christmas since the government announced its austerity budget earlier this fall. Some of the deepest cuts are coming from social welfare programs. That's no small thing in a country known for its safety net. And it's giving special resonance to a highly influential study of poverty and unemployment in Britain that was written 100 years ago by a rich factory owner named Seebohm Rowntree. And from Rowntree's hometown, now York, in the north of England, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has the story.
York is an unlikely setting for a study of urban poverty and squalor. The city is glorious, elegant and beautiful, with one of the finest cathedrals in Europe. But that, says city archivist Richard Taylor, was one of the reasons Seebohm Rowntree carried out his research on deprivation here.
Rowntree was wanting to show that these conditions existed everywhere. They existed in pretty little cities like York, and something ought to be done about them.
Seebohm was the son of a wealthy chocolate manufacturer in York. As Quakers, the Rowntrees were intent on improving the lives of the poor. Seebohm set out in the late 1890s to study the subject on his own doorstep. Here's Bridget Morris of the Rowntree Society.
Well, we're just approaching the original slum area. This is where Seebohm did a lot of his poverty work.
She's taking me to where Seebohm gathered hard evidence of poverty.
It would have been a place of enormous noise and deprivation, poor sanitation, slaughterhouses, shrieking children, a miserable place.
Seebohm and his researchers interviewed 11,000 families here. They later persuaded some of those families to keep a diary. Men like unemployed labourer John Joseph Addy gave a daily account of a hand-to-mouth existence.
Friday, 15th of July. Got up at 5 a.m, went around to several places hoping to find work, but was unsuccessful. Back home at 10 a.m, had some cold tea and bread.
Many families, it seemed, were living close to the edge of starvation.
Up at 5, walked round and round the town till 12. Nothing doing anywhere. No breakfast, no tea and no supper. Went to bed around 7:30.
Earlier social reformers had drawn attention to such miseries, but what made Rowntree's work different was that he tried for the first time to measure rigorously the scale of the deprivation.
He tried to work out what people needed to really have a living wage.
Stephen Pittam of the Rowntree Charitable Trust says Seebohm worked out exactly how much was needed for food, clothing, shelter and fuel. And then he arrived at an alarming conclusion.
10% of the people in this city, where he was a businessman, were receiving an income which was not enough to keep them in a reasonable condition.
Seabone paid his own employees more than that living wage. He lobbied other bosses to do the same. And with political friends in high places, he helped introduce the first effective safety net for the poor, pensions for the elderly, and insurance against illness and unemployment. He played a critical role in the history of Britain's welfare state.
So I'll just unlock the door.
In the city archives, Richard Taylor presides over 800 years of York history. Thousands of documents here from the 20th century attest to the huge improvement in the lives of the poor. Today, Seabone might be appalled at some aspects of the welfare state he helped to create. For example, that some people are better off on benefits than in work. But Taylor believes that even today, Seabone would still cling to a fundamental conviction.
A government should do things where it can make a difference. Government is not the enemy. Government is the solution, but the solution has to be based on rigorous scientific and economic principles.
But as deficit cutting begins in Britain, the government will argue that times have changed beyond recognition since Seabone's day. There's much less poverty in York, for example. Last week, this brass band was soliciting donations in the centre of the city. But it wasn't raising money for the poor, it was raising money for itself. In York, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today from the Marketplace desk of... well, I guess you gotta draw the line someplace. The Treasury Department issued new rules today on government benefit payments. As of March 1st, 2013, all those payments, things like Social Security and veterans benefits, are going to be paperless, direct deposit or debit card only. Treasury says it'll save $1 billion a year on printing and postage. There will be some exceptions, one of which is for people over 90 years old who might not get the new technology. They can keep on getting plain old checks. But, and here's the draw the line thing. People who are 88, 89... they got to figure it out. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow picked up 55 points, 0.5%. The NASDAQ added 18 points, about 2/3%. The S&P 500 tacked on 7 points, almost 2/3%. Thanks today to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up back here next time, the importance of saying thanks.
We're returning to civility, courtesy, and a way of actually honoring customers that has seemed far too absent, I think, for the last 20 years.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow, and thanks.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like...
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.